Rachel back there? She is. Let me just check if it's clear. She might have client stuff spread out. He picked up the desk phone and called the room 6 feet behind him. Rachel, Jack McAvoy is here. I noted the use of my full name. It made me wonder whether there was another Jack in Rachel's life, and Thomas had to be clear about which one was waiting to see her. He hung up the phone and looked up at me with a smile. It's all clear. You can go back. Thank you, Thomas. I walked around his desk and through the door centered on the wall behind him. Rachel had a long rectangular office with a small seating area in front and then an L-shaped desk with large monitors on each side so she could work different jobs simultaneously on separate computers with separate IP addresses. She looked away from one of the screens and at me as I entered and closed the door behind me. It had been at least a year since I had seen her, and that was only at the crowded open house in these offices when she announced that Raw Data was in business. There had been random texts and emails in the meantime, but I realized as I smiled at her that I had probably not been alone with her for 2 years. Jack, she said. Nothing else. No, what are you doing here? No, you can't just show up here anytime you feel like it. No, you need to make an appointment before coming here. Rachel, I said. I stepped up to her desk. Got a minute? I asked. Of course. Sit down. How are you, Jack? I wanted to go around behind the desk and pull her up out of the chair into an embrace. She still had that power. I got the urge every time I saw her. It didn't matter how long it had been. I'm good, I said as I sat down. You know, same old, same old. What about you? How's business? It's good, she said. Real good. Nobody trusts anybody anymore. That means business for me. We've got more than we can handle. We? Thomas and me. I made him a partner. He deserved it. I nodded when I couldn't find my voice. 10 years ago, we shared a dream of working side by side as private investigators. We put it off because Rachel wanted to wait until she was fully vested in her FBI pension. So she stayed with the Bureau, and I worked for the Velvet Coffin. Then the Rodney Fletcher case came up, and I put the story ahead of what we had and what we planned. Rachel was 2 years shy of full vesting when they fired her, and our relationship fell apart. Now she did background searches and private investigations without me, and I did tough watchdog reporting for the consumer. This was not the way it was supposed to be. I finally found my voice. You going to put his name on the door? I don't think so. We've already done the branding with Raw Data, and it works. So, what brings you here? Well, I was hoping maybe I could pick your brain and get some advice on a story I'm working on. Let's move over here. She gestured toward the seating area, and we shifted there, me sitting on the couch and Rachel taking the armchair across a coffee table from me. The wall behind her was hung with photos from her time with the Bureau. I knew it was a selling tool. So, she said when we were seated, I have a story, I said. I mean, I think. I wanted to run it by you, see if anything pops for you. As quickly as I could, I told the story of Tina Portrero's murder, the connection to 3 other deaths of women across the country, and the rabbit hole it had led me down. I pulled the printouts from my back pocket and read her passages from the GT-23 informed consent pages and some of the quotes from Bolander and Tina's mother. It feels like there's something there, I concluded, but I don't know what the next steps would be. First question, Rachel said. Is there any indication that the LAPD is going the same way with this? Do they know what you know? I don't know, but I doubt they've come up with 3 other cases. How did you find out about this in the first place? It doesn't feel like the new you. The consumer reporter. I had conveniently left out the part about the LAPD coming to me because I had spent a night with Tina Portrero the previous year. Now, there was no way around it. Well, I sort of knew Tina Portrero, briefly, so they came to me. You mean you're a suspect, Jack? No, more a person of interest. But that will get cleared up soon. I gave them my DNA, and it'll clear me. But then you have a big conflict of interest here. Your editor is letting you run with this? Same thing. Once the DNA clears me, there is no conflict. Yes, I knew Tina, but that does not preclude me from writing about the case. It's been done before. I wrote about my brother, and before that I knew an assistant city manager who got murdered. I wrote about that case. Yeah, but did you fuck her too? That was harsh, and it led me to realize that Rachel had a conflict of interest herself when it came to me. Though our decision to part 3 years before was mutual, I don't think either of us had gotten over the other, and possibly never would. No, I didn't fuck the assistant city manager, I said. She was just a source. I realized as soon as I said the last line that it had been a mistake. Rachel and I had had a secret relationship that blew up publicly when she revealed that she was my source on the series of stories exposing Rodney Fletcher's misdeeds. Sorry, I said quickly. I didn't mean, it's okay, Jack, Rachel said. Water under the bridge. I think you're right about this DNA stuff. There is something there, and I would pursue it. Yeah, but how? You said it's a self-regulating industry? Remember when it came out that Boeing was essentially self-regulating and self-reporting when they had those airliner crashes? You could be onto something just as big here. I don't care what it is, a government, a bureaucracy, a business. When there are no rules, then corruption sets in like rust. That's your angle. You have to find out if GT23 or any of them has ever been breached. If it has, then game over. Easier said than done. You need to ask yourself where the vulnerability is. That part you read to me? We cannot guarantee that a breach will never happen. That's important. If they can't guarantee that, then they know something. Find the vulnerabilities. Don't expect the media flack to just give them to you. I understood what she was saying, but I was on the outside looking in. The weaknesses of any system are always hidden from the outside. I know that, I said, but GT23 is like a fortress. Weren't you the one who told me once that no place is a fortress to a good reporter? There is always a way in. Former employees, current employees with grievances, who have they fired? Who have they mistreated? Competitors, jealous colleagues? There's always a way in. Okay, I'll check all of that. The collaborators. That's another vulnerability. Look at what GT23 is doing, Jack. They are handing off data. They are selling it. That is the point where they lose control of it. They don't control it physically anymore, and they don't control what's done with it. They do their due diligence on the research application and then trust that that is the research that is actually conducted. But do they ever double back and check that it is? That's the direction you have to take this. What did the mother say? What? The mother of the victim. You read me her quotes. She said Tina was never married, never wanted to be tied down to one man, was boy crazy from the start. What is all of that? It's a nice way of saying she was promiscuous. In current society, that is considered a behavioral problem in females, right? I was seeing all of her profiling instincts come into play. I may have had ulterior motives in coming to see Rachel Walling again, but now she was using her skills to give direction to my reporting, and it was beautiful. Right, I guess. It's the classic profile. A man pursues sex with multiple partners, no big deal. A woman? She's loose. She's a whore. Well, is it genetic? I nodded, remembering. Sex addiction. At least one of the GT23 collaborators is studying risky behaviors and their genetic origin. I saw that in a story. There might be others. Rachel pointed at me. Bingo, she said. Sex addiction. Who is studying the genetic relation to sex addiction? Wow, I said. Man, I wish we had this stuff when I was working bureau cases, Rachel said. It would have been a huge part of both victimology and suspect profiling. She said it wistfully, remembering her past work for the Bureau. I could tell that what I had brought to her excited her, but also served as a reminder about what she once had and once was. I almost felt bad about my motives for coming. "Ah, this is all fantastic, Rachel," I said. "Great stuff. You've given me a lot of angles to look at." "All of which I think a seasoned reporter like you already knew," she said. I looked at her. So much for my motives. She had read me the way she used to read crime scenes and killers.
"What did you really come here for, Jack?" she asked.
I nodded. "Well, that's just it," I said. "You just read me like an open book, and that's what I came for. I thought maybe you'd want to take a shot at this. Maybe profile the killer, profile the victims. I have a lot of victimology, and on the killer, I've got times, locations, how he staged things. I've got a lot." She was shaking her head before I finished.
"I've got too much going on," she said. "This week we're backgrounding candidates for the Mulholland Corridor Planning Board for the city, and I have the usual backlog from our steady clients."
"Well, I guess all that pays the bills," I said.
"Besides, I really don't want to go down that path. That was the past, Jack."
"But you were good at it, Rachel."
"I was. But doing it this way, I think it will be too much of a reminder of that past. It's taken a long time, but I've let it go."
I looked at her, trying to get a read now myself, but she had always been a hard nut to crack. I was left to take her at her word, but I wondered if the past she didn't want to return to was more about me than the job she had left behind. "Okay," I said. "I guess I should let you get back to it then." I stood up, and so did she. The shin-high coffee table was between us, and I leaned across to engage in an awkward hug. "Thanks, Rachel."
"Anytime, Jack."
I left the office and checked my phone as I walked down Main Street to the lot where I had left the Jeep. I had silenced it before going in to see Rachel, and now saw that I had missed two calls from unknown numbers and had two new messages. The first was from Lisa Hill.
"Stop harassing me."
Short and simple, followed by the hang-up. This message led me to accurately guess who the second message was from before playing it. Detective Mattson used a few more words than Hill.
"McAvoy, if you want me to put together a harassment case against you, all you have to do is keep bothering Lisa Hill. Leave her alone."
I erased both messages, my face burning with both indignation and humiliation. I was just doing my job, but it bothered me that neither Hill nor Mattson viewed it that way. To them, I was some kind of intruder. It made me all the more determined to find out what had happened to Tina Potrero and the three other women. Rachel Walling said she didn't want to venture into the past, but I did. For the first time in a long time, I had a story that had my blood moving with an addictive momentum. It was good to have that feeling back. Chapter 10. Fair Warning did not have the budget for such niceties as the LexisNexis legal search engine, but William Marchand, the lawyer who was on the board of directors and reviewed all Fair Warning stories for legal pitfalls, did have the service and offered it to our staff as just one of the many things he did for us gratis. His office, where he served most of his paying clients, was located on Victory Boulevard near the Van Nuys Civic Center and the side-by-side courthouses where he most often appeared on their behalf. I made my first stop there after leaving downtown. Marchand was in court, but his legal assistant, Sasha Nelson, was there and allowed me to sit next to her at her computer while she conducted a LexisNexis search to see if GT23 or its parent company and founding partners had ever been the subject of a lawsuit. I came across one pending action against the company and another that had been filed and dismissed when a settlement had been reached. The pending case was a wrongful termination claim filed by someone named Jason Huang.
The cause of action summary on the first page of the lawsuit stated that Huang was a regulatory affairs specialist who was fired when another employee claimed that he had fondled him during an encounter in the coffee room. Huang denied the accusation and claimed to have been fired without the due process of a full internal investigation. The lawsuit stated that the sexual harassment complaint was trumped up as a means of getting rid of Huang because he had demanded strict adherence to company protocols regarding DNA testing and research. The lawsuit also stated that the alleged victim of the unwanted sexual contact was promoted to Huang's position after he was fired, a clear indication that the termination was unlawful. What stood out to me in the filing was that Huang did not work directly for GT23 at the company's Palo Alto lab. He was technically an employee of Woodland Bio, an independent lab located in the Woodland Hills section of Los Angeles. Woodland Bio was described in the lawsuit as a GT23 subcontractor, a lab that handled some of the overflow demands of the mother company's genetic testing. Huang was suing the mother company because they had ultimate control over personnel decisions, and that was also where the money was. Huang was seeking $1.2 million in damages, saying his reputation had been ruined in the industry by the false accusation, and no other company would hire him. I asked Sasha to print out the lawsuit, which included a notifications page with the name and contact information for Huang's attorney, who is a partner in a downtown LA law firm. Sasha sensed my excitement. "Good stuff?" she asked. "Maybe," I said. "If the plaintiff or his lawyer will talk to me, it could lead to something." "Should we pull up the other case?" "Yes, sure." I was sitting on a roller chair next to Sasha's as she worked the keyboard. She was in her early 40s, had been with Marshawn for a long time, and I knew from previous conversations that she was going to law school at night while working in the office by day. She was attractive in a bookish, determined sort of way. Pretty face and eyes hidden behind eyeglasses, never lipstick or any sign that she spent much time in front of a makeup mirror. She wore no rings or earrings and had an unconscious habit of hooking her short auburn hair behind her ears as she stared at the computer screen. It turned out that there had been 6 Stanford men who had originally founded Genotype 23 to cater to the burgeoning law enforcement need for DNA lab work. But Jensen Fitzgerald had been bought out early by the 5 other partners. When years later GT23 was founded, he filed a lawsuit claiming that he was owed a piece of the GT23 action because of his standing as an original founder of the mother company. The initial response to the lawsuit said Fitzgerald had no claim to the riches generated by the new company because they were separate entities. But the LexisNexis file ended with a joint notice of dismissal, meaning the two parties had come to an agreement and the dispute was settled. The details of the settlement were kept confidential. I asked Sasha to print out the documents that were available, even though I did not see much in the way of follow-up on that case. I believed that the Huang case could be far more fruitful. After finding no other legal action regarding the company, I had Sasha enter the names of the 5 remaining founders one by one to see if there was ever a legal action personally filed by them or against them. She found only a divorce case involving one of the founders named Charles Breyer. His marriage of 24 years came to an end in a divorce petition filed 2 years earlier by his wife Anita, who made claims of intolerable cruelty and called her husband a serial philanderer. She settled the divorce for a lump sum payment of $2 million and the home they had shared in Palo Alto, which was valued at $3.2 million. "Another happy, loving couple," Sasha said. "Print it?" "Yeah, might as well print it," I said. "You sound pretty cynical about it." "Money," she said. "It's the root of all troubles. Men get rich, they think they're king of the world, then they act like it." "Is that from personal experience?" I asked. "No, but you see it a lot when you work in a law office." "You mean with the cases?" "Yes, the cases. Definitely not the boss." She got up and went to the printer, where all the pages I had asked for were waiting. She tapped them together and then put a clip on the stack before handing it to me. I stood up and moved around from behind her desk.
How is law school? I asked.
All good, she said. 2 years down, one to go.
Think you'll work here with Bill or strike out on your own?
I'm hoping I'll be right here working with you and Fair Warning and our other clients.
I nodded. Cool, I said. Well, as always, thanks for your help. Tell Bill thanks as well. You two really take good care of us.
We're happy to, she said. Good luck with the story.
When I got back to the office, Myron Levin was closed up in the conference room. Through the glass, I could see him talking to a man and woman, but they didn't look like cops, so I assumed it had nothing to do with my pursuits. I looked over at Emily Atwater and her cubby, caught her attention, and pointed to the conference room door.
Donus, Emily said.
I nodded, sat down in my cubicle, and started the search for Jason Hwang. I found no phone number or social media footprint. He wasn't on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. I got up and walked over to Emily. I knew she was on LinkedIn, the professional networking site, and I wasn't.
I'm looking for a guy, I said. Can you do a quick check on LinkedIn?
Let me finish this line, she said. She kept typing. I checked on Myron through the glass, and it looked like the woman was writing a check.
Looks like we'll get paid this week, I said.
Emily stopped typing and glanced at the conference room window.
She's writing a check, I explained.
Six figures, I hope, Emily said.
I knew Fair Warning's biggest financial support came from individuals and family foundations. Sometimes there were one-to-one matching grants from journalism foundations.
Okay, what's the name? Emily asked.
Jason Hwang, I said, and spelled it.
Emily typed. She had a habit of leaning forward when she typed, as though she was diving headfirst into whatever she was writing. With powder blue eyes, pale skin, and white blonde hair, she seemed just a few genetic ticks away from being full albino. She was also tall, not just for a woman, but for anyone, at least 6 feet in flats. She chose to accentuate this signature feature by always wearing heels. On top of that, she was a damn good reporter, having been a war correspondent followed by stints in New York and Washington, D.C., before heading west to California, where she eventually landed at Fair Warning. Her two separate postings in Afghanistan had left her tough and unflappable. Great attributes for a reporter.
Who is he? She asked.
He worked for a lab that subcontracted for the company I'm looking at, I said. Then he got fired and sued them.
GT-23?
How do you know that?
Myron.
He said you might need help on it.
I just need to find this guy.
She nodded.
Well, there's four here, she said.
I remembered how Hwang was described in the lawsuit. Lives in L.A., I said. He's got a master's in life sciences from UCLA.
She started looking at the pedigrees of the four Jason Hwangs, shaking her head and saying nope each time.
Strike four and you're out. None of these are even from L.A.
Okay, thanks for looking. You could try LexisNexis.
I did. I went back to my desk. Of course, I had not run Hwang's name through LexisNexis as I should have. I now called the law office and quietly asked Sasha Nelson to do the search. I heard her type it in.
Only the lawsuit comes back up, she said.
Sorry.
That's okay, I said. I have a few other tricks up my sleeve.
After hanging up, I continued the search for Jason Hwang. I knew I could simply call the attorney who had filed the lawsuit on Hwang's behalf, but my hope was to get to Hwang without his lawyer sitting on his shoulder and trying to control the flow of information. The attorney was useful, however, in that he had listed Hwang's credentials and experience in the claim, noting his receiving the master's degree from UCLA in 2012 before being recruited by Woodland Bio. That told me that Hwang was a young man, most likely in his early 30s. He had started at Woodland as a lab technician before being promoted to regulatory affairs specialist just a year before he was fired. I conducted a search for professional organizations in the DNA field,
and came up with a group called the National Society of Professional Geneticists. Its website menu had a page labeled Looking for a Lab, which I took to be a Help Wanted section. Huang claimed in his still-pending lawsuit that he had become a pariah in the genetics industry because of the accusation made against him. In the Me Too era, just an accusation was enough to end a career. I thought maybe there was a chance Huang had posted his resume and contact information in an effort to land an interview somewhere. He could have even been instructed to do so by his lawyer to help prove his inability to get work in the field. The resumes were listed in alphabetical order, and I quickly found Jason Huang's curriculum vitae as the last entry under the letter H. It was the jackpot. It included an email address, phone number, and mailing address. The work experience section revealed the responsibilities of his GT23 job as a regulatory specialist. He had served as a liaison between the company and the many different regulatory agencies that kept watch on the various aspects of DNA analysis. The primary agencies were the Food and Drug Administration, the Department of Health and Human Services, and the Federal Trade Commission. I noticed Huang had also listed several references. Most were personal or academic supporters, but one was a man named Gordon Webster, who is described as an investigator with the Federal Trade Commission. I wrote the name down, thinking that Webster might be useful to interview. I wrote Huang's details down as well. I was in business and keeping my momentum. If Huang's mailing address was his home, he lived just over the hill in West Hollywood. I checked the time and realized that if I left the office now, I could probably get through Laurel Canyon before it became clogged with rush hour traffic. I put a fresh notebook and batteries for my tape recorder into my backpack before heading to the door. Chapter 11. The winding two-lane snake that was Laurel Canyon Boulevard took nearly a half hour to pass. I relearned another object lesson about Los Angeles. There was no rush hour because every hour was rush hour. The address on Jason Huang's CV corresponded to a home on Willoughby Avenue, in a neighborhood of expensive homes with high hedges. It seemed too nice for an out-of-work biologist in his early 30s. I parked and walked through an archway cut into a 6-foot-thick hedge and knocked on the aquamarine door of a 2-story white cube. After knocking, I rang the doorbell when I should have done just one or the other. But following the doorbell, I heard a dog start to bark inside, and then the sound was quickly cut off by someone yelling the dog's name, Tipsy. The door opened, and a man stood there, cradling a toy poodle under one arm. The dog was as white as the house. The man was Asian and very small. Not just short, but small in all dimensions. "Hi, I'm looking for Jason Huang," I said. "Who are you?" he said. "Why are you looking for him?" "I'm a reporter. I'm working on a story about GT23, and I would like to talk to him about it." "What kind of story?" "Are you Jason Huang? I'll tell him what kind of story." "I'm Jason. What is this story?" "I'd rather not talk about it standing out here. Is there a place we can go to sit down and talk? Maybe inside or somewhere nearby?" It was a tip my editor Foley had given me when I started out in the business. Never do an interview at the door. People can shut the door if they don't like what you ask. "Do you have a card or some sort of ID?" Huang asked. "Sure," I said. I dug a business card out of my wallet and handed it to him. I also showed him a press pass issued 6 years earlier by the Sheriff's Department when I was regularly writing crime stories for the Velvet Coffin. Huang studied both, but didn't mention that the press pass was dated 2013, or that the man in the photo looked a lot younger than me. "Okay," Huang said, handing me back the card. "You can come in." He stepped back to allow me entrance. "Thank you," I said. He led me through the entryway to a living room decorated in white and aqua furnishings. He gestured toward the couch, that was for me, while he sat on a matching stuffed chair. He put the dog down next to him on the chair. He was wearing white pants and a sea foam green golf shirt. He blended in perfectly with the house's design and decor, and I didn't think that was by happenstance. "Do you live here alone?" I asked. "No," Huang said. He offered no further details.
Well, as I said at the door, I'm doing a story about GT-23, and I came across your lawsuit. It's still pending, correct?
It's pending. We don't have a trial date yet, he said. But I can't talk to you because the case is still active.
Well, your case is not really what I'm writing about. If I steer clear of the lawsuit, can I ask you a few questions?
No, impossible. My lawyer said I could not speak at all when the other journalist called. I wanted to, but he wouldn't let me.
I was suddenly gripped by a reporter's greatest fear, being scooped. Another journalist might be following the same trail as me.
Who was the other journalist? I asked.
I don't remember, Huang said. My lawyer told him no.
Well, was it recent? Or are you talking about when you filed the lawsuit?
Yes, when I filed. I felt a wave of relief. The lawsuit had been filed almost a year ago. It was probably a routine call from a reporter, probably from the LA Times, who had noticed the lawsuit on the courthouse docket and called for a comment. What if we talk off the record? I said. I don't quote you or use your name.
I don't know, Huang said. It still sounds risky. I don't even know you, and you want me to trust you?
This was a dance I had engaged in many times before. People often said they couldn't or didn't want to talk. The trick was to leverage their anger and give them a safe outlet for it. Then they would talk.
All I can say is that I would protect you from being identified, I said. My own credibility is at stake. I burn a source, and no source will ever trust me. I went to jail once for 63 days because I wouldn't give up the name of a source.
Huang looked horrified. Mentioning that experience often worked with people on the fence about talking to me.
What happened? Huang asked.
The judge finally let me go, I said. He knew I wasn't going to give up the name.
All of that was true, but I left out the part about my source, Rachel Walling, coming forward and revealing herself. After that, there was no point in continuing the contempt order, and the judge released me.
The thing is, if I talk, they'll know it came from me, Huang said. They'll read the story and say, who else could it come from?
Well, your information would be for background only. I won't record. I don't even have to take notes. I'm just trying to understand how all of this works.
Huang paused and then made a decision.
Ask your questions, and if I don't like them, I won't answer.
Fair enough.
I had not really thought about how I would explain myself should Huang agree to talk to me, on or off the record. Now, it was time. Like a good police detective, I didn't want to give the subject of my interview all my information. I didn't know him and didn't know who he might pass it on to. He was worried about trusting me, but I also had to worry about trusting him.
Let me start by explaining who I am and what I'm doing, I began. I work for a news site called Fair Warning. It's consumer protection reporting, you know, watching out for the little guy. And I've been assigned to look at the security of the personal information and biological material in the genetic analytics field.
Huang immediately scoffed.
What security? He said.
I wanted to write the line down because I instinctively saw it as possibly the first quote in a story. It was provocative and would pull the reader in. But I couldn't. I had made a deal with Huang.
It sounds like you were not impressed by the security at GT-23, I said. The question was deliberately open-ended. He could run with it if he wished.
Not the lab, Huang said. I ran a tight lab. We adhere to all protocols, and I will prove that in court. It was what happened afterward.
Afterward? I prompted.
The places the data went. The company wanted the money. They didn't care where it went as long as they were getting paid.
When you say they, you're talking about GT-23.
Yes, of course. They went public and needed more revenue to support the stock, so they were wide open for business. They lowered the bar.
Give me an example.
Too many to list. We were shipping DNA all over the world, thousands of samples. The company needed the money, and no one was turned away as long as it was a lab registered with the FDA or the equivalent in other countries.
So then they had to be legit. It wasn't like somebody drives up and says, I need DNA.
I'm not understanding your concern.
It's the Wild West right now. There are so many directions to go with genetic research. It's really in its infancy. And we, meaning the company, don't control what happens with the bio and how it's used once it goes out the door. That's the FDA's problem, not ours. That was the attitude. And let me tell you, the FDA didn't do jack.
Okay, I get that, and I'm not saying that's a good thing. But wasn't there the safety that it was all anonymous? I mean, these researchers were given the DNA, but not the identities of the participants, right?
Of course, but that's not the point. You're thinking in the present. What about the future? This science is very young. We haven't even had the whole genome for 20 years. New things are discovered about it every day. Will what is anonymous now stay that way in 20 years? In 10 years? Or will usernames and passwords not matter? What if your DNA is your identifier and you've already given it away?
Huang raised his hand and pointed a finger at the ceiling.
Even the military, he said. Did you know that this year the Pentagon told all members of the military not to do DNA kits because of the security issues they pose?
I had not seen that report, but I did grasp Huang's point. Were you warning GT-23 about this? I asked.
Of course I was, Huang said. Every day. I was the only one.
I read the lawsuit.
I can't talk about that, even off the record. My lawyer, I'm not asking you to.
But the lawsuit, it says the employee who filed the complaint against you, David Shanley, set you up to get your job, and that it was not investigated by the company.
It was all lies.
I know, I get that, but the motive. You don't think it could have been to shut you up about this, about the lack of controls or concern over where the DNA was going? All I know is that Shanley got my job. He lies about me and gets my fucking job. That could have been his reward for getting you out of the company. They were afraid you would be a whistleblower.
My lawyer has subpoenaed company documents, emails. If it's there, we'll find it.
Let's go back to what you were saying about the DNA being sold by the company. Can you remember any names of labs or biotechs that were sold samples?
There were too many to remember. We put biopacks together almost every single day.
Well, who is the biggest buyer of DNA? Do you remember?
Not really.
Why don't you tell me what it is you're looking for? I looked at him for a long moment. I was the seeker of facts and information. I was supposed to hold them close to the vest and not share them until it was time to put them into a story. But I felt that Huang knew more than he was saying, even if he didn't yet realize it. I felt that I needed to break my own rule and give in order to get. Okay, I'll tell you why I'm really here.
Please.
A young woman was murdered last week in L.A. Her neck broken. I was looking into it and came up with three other women in California, Texas, and Florida who were killed in exactly the same way. I don't understand. What does this have to do with?
Maybe nothing.
Maybe it's all coincidence. But all four of the women were GT-23 participants. They didn't know each other, but they had all sent in their DNA. Four women killed in the same way, four women who were participants. To me, that moves beyond coincidence, and that's why I'm here. Huang said nothing. He seemed to be contemplating the possibilities of what I was telling him. There's more, I said. I haven't done a lot of work on this yet, but there may be another commonality.
Which is what?
Huang asked. Some sort of addictive behavior. The LA woman had been treated for alcoholism and drugs. She was sort of a party girl, went out to a lot of clubs, met men in bars.
Dirty Four.
What?
Dirty Four. It's what some geneticists call the DRD4 gene.
Why?
It has been identified in relation to at-risk behavior and addiction, including sex addiction.
Is it in the female genome?
Both male and female.
But take a woman who frequently goes to bars by herself to pick up men for sex. Are you saying it's because she has the DRD4 gene?
Possibly. But the science is in its infancy, and everybody is individual.
I don't think you can say for sure.
Well, as far as you know,
are any of GT23's collaborators studying the Dirty 4 gene? It's possible, but that's what I'm saying is wrong. We can sell DNA for one purpose, but who's to stop them from using it for another purpose? What stops them from selling it again to a third party? I saw a story about the company. It listed some of the places the DNA was going. It mentioned a study of addiction and risky behavior at a lab down in Irvine. Yes, Orange Nano. That's the lab? That's the lab. Big buyers. Who runs it? A bio guy named William Orton. Is it part of UC Irvine? No, privately funded. Probably Big Pharma. You see, GT23 like to sell to the private labs better than to universities. The private labs paid more, and there wasn't a public record of transactions. Did you deal with Orton? A few times on the phone. That was it. Why were you on the phone with him? Because he would call me and ask about a biopack. You know, checking to see if it had shipped or maybe to add to an existing order. He ordered more than once? Sure, many times. Like every week or what? No, like once a month or sometimes longer. And what would an order be? How much? A biopack contains 100 samples. Why would he need to keep ordering biopacks? For continuing research purposes. They all do that. Did Orton ever talk about his lab's research? Sometimes. What did he say? Not much, just that it was his field of study. Addiction, in many forms. Alcohol, drugs, sex. He wanted to isolate those genes and develop therapies. But that's how I know about Dirty 4, from him. He used the phrase Dirty 4? Yes. Had anybody else used it with you before? Not that I remember. Have you ever been down to Orange Nano? No, never. My only contact was by phone and email. I nodded. I knew at that moment that I would be going down to Irvine to visit Orange Nano. Chapter 12. I decided that the best use of my time would be to get into the crush of cars waiting to go over the mountain to the valley through one of the choked-off freeways or mountain roads. That could take 90 minutes at this time of day. One of the things that made the City of Angels so beautiful also created one of its greatest hardships. The Santa Monica Mountains cut through the middle of the city, leaving the San Fernando Valley, where I lived and worked, on the north side, and the rest of the city, including Hollywood and the west side, to the south. There were two freeways that cut through the big passes and several two-lane winders. Take your pick, but at 5 o'clock on a weekday, you weren't going anywhere. I drove over to Kofax Coffee and set up with a cappuccino and my laptop at a table beneath the display of bobbleheads and other Dodger paraphernalia. I first sent Myron Levin an email briefly summarizing my interview with Jason Hwang and the leads I had picked up regarding Orange Nano. Next, I opened a file and tried to recall everything Hwang had told me, writing a detailed summary of the interview from memory. I was halfway through my second cappuccino when I took a call from Myron. Where are you? Other side of the hill. I'm at a coffee shop on Fairfax, writing up notes and waiting out the traffic. It's 6 now. When do you think you're coming back? I'm almost finished with my notes, then I'll wade into the traffic. So, by 7, you think? Hopefully before. Okay, I'll wait for you. I want to talk about this story. Well, do you want to just talk now? Did you get my email? I just had a killer interview over here. I got the email, but let's talk it out when you get here. Okay, I'm going to try Nichols Canyon. Maybe I get lucky. I'll see you when I see you. After the call, I wondered why Myron wanted to talk face to face. My guess was that he might not be as convinced as I was that there was something here. He had not commented on my email, and it seemed as though I would need to sell him on the story all over again. Nichols Canyon was a charmed route. The traffic flowed smoothly through the hillside neighborhoods above Hollywood until the unavoidable bottleneck at Mulholland Drive. But once I got through, it was clear sailing again down into the valley. I walked into the office at 6:40 and considered it an accomplishment. Myron was in the conference room with Emily Atwater. I put my backpack down on my desk and gave him a wave through the window. Since I had gotten back earlier than expected, I figured he was probably in a story conference with her. But he waved me in and made no move to dismiss Emily when I entered.
"Jack," he said, "I want to bring Emily in to help out with your story."
I looked at him for a long moment before responding. He had done a smart thing. He had kept Emily in the room because that would make it harder for me to push back against his plan. Still, I couldn't just accept the encroachment without protest.
"How come?" I asked. "I mean, I think I have it covered. This orange nano angle you mentioned in your email looks promising," Myron said. "I don't know if you know Emily's pedigree, but she covered higher ed for the Orange County Register before coming to Fair Warning. She still has contacts down there, and I think it would be good for you two to partner up."
"Partner up? But it's my story."
"Of course it is, but sometimes stories get bigger and need more hands, more experienced hands. Like I said, she knows people down there. You also have the police situation to deal with."
"What police situation?"
"As far as I know, you're still on their person of interest list. Have you talked to them lately? Have they processed your DNA?"
"I haven't talked to them today, but that's not a situation. As soon as they run the DNA, I'll be off the list. I was planning on going down to Orange Nano first thing tomorrow."
"That sounds good, but that's what I mean. I don't want you going there without preparation. Have you done any backgrounding on the lab or its people?"
"Not yet, but I will. That's why I came back to the office, to do some research."
"Well, talk to Emily. She's already done some work, and maybe you two can come up with a plan of action."
I didn't say anything. I just looked down at the table. I knew I wasn't going to change his mind, and maybe also knew, grudgingly, that he was right. Two reporters were better than one. Besides, having half the staff on the story would make Myron more invested in it.
"Okay," Myron said. "Then I'll let you two get after it. Keep me in the loop."
Myron got up and left the room, closing the door behind him. Before I could speak, Emily did.
"Sorry, Jack," she said. "I didn't go asking to be a part of this. He pulled me in."
"Don't worry," I said. "I'm not blaming you. I just thought I had things in hand, you know?"
"Yes, but while we were waiting for you, I did do a preliminary workup on William Orton, the guy who runs Orange Nano."
"And?"
"I think there's something there. Orton left UC Irvine to start Orange Nano."
"So?"
"So? You don't just leave a UC job when you're tenured and you have a full lab at your disposal and unlimited doctoral candidates at your beck and call. You can start an outside company or a lab, but the university is your anchor. You keep that affiliation because it works for you. It's easier to get grants, professional exposure, everything."
"So something happened."
"Right, something happened. And we're going to find out what it is."
"How?"
"Well, I'm going to work UCI. I still have a few sources there. And you do what you said. You work Orange Nano. I don't want to step on your toes, but I think I can help here."
"Okay.
Good then.
This is how I think we should work it."
Over the next hour, I shared everything I knew so far about the deaths of the four women and GT-23. Emily asked many questions, and together we made an action plan that had us attacking the story from two angles. I went from being reluctant to being glad she was on board. She was not as experienced as I was, but she was impressive, and I knew she had probably broken the most important stories Fair Warning had put out in the last couple of years. I left the office that night believing Myron had made a good move, putting us together. It was 8 o'clock when I got back to my Jeep and drove home. After parking in the garage, I walked to the front of the apartment building to check my mail. It had been a week since I checked the box, and this was primarily to empty it of all the junk mail I received. The building's management provided a trash can next to the bank of mailboxes, so junk mail could be quickly transferred to its final destination. I was going through my stack, dropping one piece after the other into the bin, when I heard steps coming from behind me, and then a voice I recognized.
"Mr. McAvoy, just who we were looking for." It was Mattson and Sakai. Mattson was back to saying my name wrong.
He was carrying a folded document and held it out to me as he approached in the dimming light of the day.
"What's this?" I asked.
"This is a warrant," Mattson said. "All signed, sealed, and delivered by the city attorney's office. You're under arrest."
"What? Arrest for what?"
"That would be Section 148 of the California Penal Code. Obstructing a police officer in the discharge of his duty. That officer would be me, and the investigation of the murder of Christina Potrero. We told you to back off, McAvoy, but no, you kept harassing our witnesses and lying your ass off."
"What are you talking about? I didn't obstruct you or anybody. I'm a reporter working a story and—"
"No, you're a person of interest and I told you to back off. You didn't, so now you're fucked. Put your hands up on that wall."
"This is crazy. You're going to create a major embarrassment for your department. Do you know that? You ever heard of a thing called freedom of the press?"
"Tell it to the judge. Now turn around and put your hands up there. I'm going to search you for weapons."
"Jesus, Mattson, this makes no sense. Is it because you don't have jack shit on Potrero and you want a distraction?"
Mattson said nothing. I did what I was told and moved to the wall, not wanting to add resisting arrest to the bogus charge of obstruction. Mattson quickly searched me and emptied my pockets, giving my phone, wallet, and keys to Sakai. I turned my head enough to check out Sakai, and he didn't look like a man who was fully on board with this move.
"Detective Sakai, did you try to talk him out of this?" I asked.
"This is a mistake, and you're going to go down with him when the shit hits the fan."
"It would be best if you kept quiet," Sakai said.
"I'm not going to keep quiet," I threw back at him. "The whole world is going to hear about this. This is bullshit."
One by one, Mattson pulled my hands off the wall and cuffed my wrists behind my back. He led me to their car, which was parked against the curb. As I was about to be placed in the back seat, I saw a neighbor from the building come up the sidewalk with her dog on a leash and stare silently at my humiliation while her dog yipped at me. I looked away. Then Mattson put his hand on the top of my head and pushed me down into the back seat.
Hammond. Chapter 13. Hammond was in the lab at his station, spreading nitrocellulose over a gel tray he had just retrieved from the cooker. He felt his watch vibrate against the inside of his wrist. He knew it was one of his flags. He had gotten an alert. But the process could not be interrupted. He continued his work, next blotting the gel tray with paper towels, making sure to keep uniform pressure on the gel across the entire tray. When he was finished blotting, he knew he could take a break from the work. He checked his watch and read the text. "Hey, Hammer, want to grab some beers?" This was a cover text, emanating from a cellular relay coded as Max. Of course, Max didn't exist, but anybody who happened to see the message pop up on his watch, even worn on the inside of his wrist, would not be suspicious, though the message came in at 3:14 a.m., and all the bars were closed. Hammond went to his lab table and pulled his laptop from his backpack. He checked the other stations in the lab and saw that nobody was watching him. Only three other technicians were working graveyard anyway, and there were empty stations separating all of them. It was a budgetary thing. The wait time on rape kits and some cold case homicides was still months, where it should be weeks, if not days. But the city's budget masters had cut back on the lab's third shift. Hammond expected that soon he would be working days again. He opened the laptop and used his thumb to authenticate. He went to the surveillance software and pulled up the alert. He saw that one of the detectives he was monitoring had just made an arrest and put someone in jail. His filing the arrest report had triggered the alert. Hammond's partner, Roger Vogel, had hacked the internal LAPD network and set the whole alert system up. He had master skills. Hammond checked the other texts and then looked back at his screen. He called up the report filed by Detective David Mattson. He had arrested a man named Jack McAvoy and booked him at the jail at LAPD's Van Nuys division. Hammond read the details of the arrest, then reached into the backpack for the phone he carried in an inside zippered pocket. The phone for emergency contact. He turned the phone on and waited for it to boot up. Meantime, he closed out the arrest report and went to the public access page for the city's jail system. He put in the name Jack McAvoy and was soon looking at the mugshot of the man. He looked angry and defiant as he stared at the camera. There was a scar on his upper left cheek. It looked like it could have been easily erased by plastic surgery, but McAvoy kept it. Hammond thought it might be some sort of badge of honor with the reporter. The phone was ready. Hammond called the single number stored in its memory. Vogel answered with sleep in his voice.
"This better be good."
"I think we have a problem."
"What?"
"Matson arrested somebody tonight."
"That's not a problem. That's good."
"No, not for the murder. It was a journalist. He was arrested for obstructing the investigation."
"You woke me for that."
"It means he may be on to this."
"How could that be? The police aren't even..."
"Call it a hunch. Whatever."
Hammond looked at the mugshot again, angry and determined. McAvoy knew something.
"I think we have to watch him," he said.
"All right, whatever," Vogel said. "Text the details and I'll see what's out there. When did this happen?"
"They booked him last night. I got flagged on the software you set up."
"I'm glad it worked. You know, this could be a good thing for us."
"How?"
"I don't know yet. Couple of ways."
"Let me go to work on it. You want to meet in the morning? In daylight?"
"Can't." "You fucking vampire. Sleep later."
"No, I have court first thing. Testifying today."
"What case? Maybe I'll come watch."
"A cold case. Guy killed a girl 30 years ago. He kept the knife, thought washing it off would be okay."
"Dumbass. Where?"
"Up in the hills. Threw her off an overlook on Mulholland."
"I mean, where's the courtroom?"
"Oh."
Hammond realized he didn't know himself.
"Hold on."
He dug into the backpack and pulled out the notice to appear.
"Downtown Criminal Courts, Department 108, Judge Riley. I have to be there at 9 to go on first."
"Well, maybe I'll see you there. Meantime, I'm on this reporter. Does he work at the Times?"
"The arrest report didn't say. It said occupation journalist, and the summary said he was obstructing the investigation by harassing witnesses, not revealing he was an acquaintance of the victim."
"Holy shit, Hammer. You left the key part out. He knew the victim?"
"That's what it says on the report."
"Okay, I'm on it. Maybe I see you in court."
"Okay."
Vogel disconnected. Hammond turned off his phone and dropped it back into his backpack. He stood there, thinking about things.
"Hammer?"
He whipped around. Cassandra Nash was standing there, his supervisor. She had come out of her office without him noticing.
Yes? What's up?"
"Where are you with that batch? It looks like you're just standing there."
"No, I mean, I was just taking a second. I'm blotting and was just giving it a minute, then I'll start hybridization."
"Good. So you'll get that done before end of shift?"
"Of course, absolutely."
"And you've got court in the morning, right?"
"Yes, all set on that too."
"Good. Then I'll leave you to it. You hear anything about the next deployment?"
"As far as I know, we're still on third shift. I'll let you know what I know when I know it."
Hammond nodded and watched her go check on the other techs, doing her supervising thing. He hated Cassandra Nash. Not because she was his boss. It was because she was aloof and fake. She spent her money on designer handbags and shoes. She talked about fancy restaurants she and her douchebag husband went to for chef tastings. In his mind, Hammond had conflated her name to cash because he believed she was wholly motivated by money and possessions the way all women were. "Fuck them," he thought, as he watched Nash talk to one of the other technicians. He went back to the gel he was prepping.
Chapter 14. At 9 a.m., Hammond sat on a marble bench in the hallway of the ninth floor of the criminal courts building. He had been told to wait there until it was time for him to testify. On the bench next to him were his notes and charts regarding the case, and a cup of black coffee from the snack bar near the elevator alcove. The coffee was terrible. Not the designer stuff he was used to. He needed it because he was dragging after a full 8 hours on the graveyard shift, but he was having a hard time stomaching the harsh brew and feared it would give him stomach issues that might haunt him on the witness stand. He stopped drinking it. At 9:20, Detective Kleber finally stepped halfway out of the courtroom and waved Hammond over. Kleber was the lead detective on the case. "Sorry, they had to argue a motion before bringing the jury in," he explained. "But now we're ready."
"Me too," Hammond said.
He had testified many times before, and it was now a routine, all except for his satisfaction in knowing that he was the hammer. His testimony always sealed the deal, and from the witness stand, he had the best angle on the moment, the second when even the defendant was convinced by Hammond's testimony and the hope went out of his eyes. He stood in front of the witness stand, raised his hand, and took the oath to tell the truth. He spelled his first and last names, Marshall Hammond, and then stepped up and took the witness seat that was between Judge Vincent Riley and the jury. He looked at the jurors and smiled, ready for the first question. The prosecutor was named Gaines Walsh. He handled many of the LAPD's cold cases, and so Hammond had testified on direct examination from him many times before. He practically knew the questions before they were asked, but acted as though each one was a new one to consider. Hammond was a slightly built man, never played sports while growing up, with a professorial goatee whose reddish whiskers contrasted with his dark brown hair. His skin was paper white after nearly a year on the midnight shift. Vogel's teasing on the phone call had been on point. He looked like a vampire caught in daylight.
"Mr. Hammond, can you tell the jury what you do for a living?" Walsh asked.
"I'm a DNA technician," Hammond said. "I work in the Los Angeles Police Department's bioforensic lab located at Cal State LA."
"How long have you had that position?"
21 months with the LAPD. Before that, I worked for 8 years in the bioforensics lab for the Orange County Sheriff's Department."
"Can you tell the ladies and gentlemen of the jury what your duties are in the LAPD lab?"
"My responsibilities include processing forensic cases that require DNA analysis, generating reports based on the conclusions of that analysis, and then testifying about those conclusions in court."
"Can you tell us a little bit about your background education in the field of DNA and genetics?"
"Yes, I have a Bachelor of Arts degree in biochemistry from the University of Southern California and a Master's in Life Sciences with a specialty in genetics from the University of California at Irvine."
Walsh fake smiled, as he did at this point in every trial.
"Life sciences," he said. "Is that what we older folks used to call plain old biology?"
Hammond fake smiled back, as he did at every trial.
"Yes, it is," he said.
"Can you describe what DNA is and what it does in layman's terms?" Walsh asked.
"I can try," Hammond said. "DNA is short for deoxyribonucleic acid. It is a molecule composed of two strands that twist around each other, forming a double helix that carries the genetic code of a living thing. By code, I really mean instructions for the development of that organism. In human beings, DNA contains all our hereditary information and therefore determines everything about us, from the color of our eyes to the function of our brains. 99% of the DNA in all human beings is identical. That last 1% and the myriad combinations within it is what makes each of us completely unique."
Hammond gave the answer like a high school biology teacher. He spoke slowly and recited the information with a tone of awe. Walsh then moved on and led him quickly through the basics of his assignment to the case. This part was so routine, Hammond was able to go on autopilot and glance a few times at the defendant. It was the first time he had seen him in person. Robert Earl Dykes, a 59-year-old plumber, had long been suspected of killing his ex-fiancée, Wilma Fournette, in 1990, stabbing her to death, then throwing her body down a hillside off Mulholland Drive. Now he was finally brought to justice. He sat at the defense table in an ill-fitting suit his lawyer had given him. He had a yellow legal pad in front of him, in case he came up with a genius question to pass to the lawyer next to him. But Hammond could see it was blank. There would be no question from him, or his lawyer, that could undo the damage Hammond would inflict. He was the hammer, and it was about to come down. "Is this the knife that you tested for blood and DNA?" Walsh asked. He was holding up a clear evidence bag containing an opened switchblade. "Yes, it is," Hammond said. "Can you tell us how it came to you?" "Yes. It had been sealed in evidence from the case since the original 1990 investigation. Detective Kleber reopened the case and brought it to me." "Why you?" "I should have said he brought it to the DNA unit and it was assigned to me on rotation." "What did you do with it?" "I opened the package and examined the knife visually for blood and then under magnification. The knife appeared to be clean, but I could see that there was a spring-loaded mechanism in the handle, so I asked for a knife expert from the Toolmark unit to come to the lab to disassemble the weapon."
"Who was that?"
"Gerald Lattice."
"And he opened the knife for you?"
"He took it apart, and then I examined the spring mechanism under a lab magnifier. I saw what I believed to be a minute amount of dried blood on the coil of the spring. I then began a DNA extraction protocol."
Walsh walked Hammond through the science. This was the boring technical part, where the danger was that the jurors' thoughts could wander off. Walsh wanted them keenly interested in the DNA findings and asked quick, short questions that required quick, short answers. The provenance of the knife would have already been testified to by Kleber. The knife was confiscated from Dykes when he was originally questioned in the investigation. The original detectives had it examined for blood by a lab using archaic methods and materials that were told it was clean. When Kleber decided to reopen the case at the urging of the victim's sister, he took another look at the knife and brought it to the DNA lab. Finally, Walsh arrived at the point where Hammond provided his findings that the DNA extracted from the minute amount of blood on the spring of the switchblade mechanism matched the DNA of the victim, Wilma Fournette. "The DNA profile developed from the material on the knife does match the profile from the victim's blood obtained during the autopsy," Hammond said.
"How close is the match?" Walsh asked.
"It is a unique match, a perfect match."
"Can you tell the jurors if there is a statistic associated with that perfect match?"
"Yes. We generate statistics based on the human population of Earth to give a weight to that match. In this case, the victim was African American. In the African American database, the frequency of this DNA profile is 1 in 13 quadrillion unrelated individuals.